7:03. We're going to start the March 26th special meeting for the school committee. And I want to thank you all very much, for those in attendance as well. And so, but without further ado, get over to Superintendent Jaeger.
Okay, thank you. Good evening, everyone. And thank you for being here, and for school committee, thank you for finding the time for a special meeting. We put out a calendar in advance. This is one of those meetings that, just given the timeliness of information, it felt most appropriate to get everyone in the same room, to provide an update on what's been done so far with regard to comprehensive facilities analysis, and assessment rather, and then also to just talk through next steps. As you may be aware, we are planning to engage with various stakeholders in some forums, which we'll hear about later. But it made sense for timeliness to just get some more information out, kind of an update of where we are today and what we will be looking to move and do moving forward. So without further ado, we're joined tonight by Dr. Fran Locker, who is here. Dr. Locker is a longtime Franklin partner and has worked with Franklin Public Schools in a variety of capacities around visioning in the past. As early as 2011, Fran, is that the last time you were here?
Yeah.
And one of the outcomes of that was our Franklin Arts Academy, through some of that work and that leadership to lead us through. So we are at the next iteration, the next era of Franklin Public Schools to look at revisiting our vision and to try to move that work forward. And I'm not going to steal Dr. Locker's thunder, but I did prepare about 10 slides as a review of the big picture process of where we're at. And I just wanted to take a few minutes to just orient us, and then I'm going to kick it over to you, Fran, okay?
Sure.
Okay, so I will share my screen for those on Zoom, but also we're projecting the same presentation in the room.
And Superintendent Jaeger, I apologize. Pause in one moment. So message Zoom might not be working. Just wanted to confirm that.
Zoom's not, not like volume-wise, or? Because I'm in the Zoom.
It's working. You have confirmation. So
I can see it.
Okay.
Is the volume working?
Steve Sherlock was just logged in. He was in and heard.
Yeah, in and heard. Okay, never mind. All right, perfect. Thank you very much.
Unless you hear something different.
I will.
Okay. Okay. So this is just an update based on the previous update I provided in, I want to say early January, maybe the first meeting, just regarding where we have been. So just to bring people up to speed, the purpose of this work was really to look at our environments, our educational spaces, look at our enrollment forecast and demographic information, forecasting ahead, the physical state of our buildings, and that's across all schools, not just one school in particular, but all schools within the district. And really try to come up with a plan that has short-term and long-term goals and a vision for Franklin Public Schools as it relates. This is just a brief history. We had a demographic study done in 2019. It was then redone. You may recall February 5th, Dr. McKibben presented that information to the Comprehensive Facilities Subcommittee to share some of that information. We had, in 2020, we had a report done by Kessel Booz on the facilities. After that, in 2021, we closed Davis Thayer Elementary School, redistricted those students to Keller. In 2022, we conducted a redistricting analysis in an effort to try to look at the best way to optimize our enrollment and some of the information that we had at that time. And through that process, we provided some recommendations, and the majority of the school committee at that time wanted more information to kind of zoom out and look at the whole district as a whole, look at all schools, and to really do work that broadened the scope of not just redistricting for a few schools or looking at that across the way, but look at all schools as a whole in general. So we've taken that information and have been conducting a comprehensive school facilities analysis. It's included population, educational visioning, and educational adequacy of our buildings, and facilities assessment as well. And ultimately, this is intended to lead to a master plan for the district, ultimately arriving at recommendations for how we can move forward as a district in a way that best positions us to educate students within Franklin, within the scope of the schools we have, the the methods and manners of which we educate kids and how we deliver instruction across all schools and across all levels. This is just an update. If you recall, in January, the right-hand column that had next steps had much more. I've transferred them to the left if they've been completed. So if you look at the bottom four, three steps have been completed since the last update. We have one remaining, which is to look at the using that information in the enrollment to make and inform recommendations towards a long-term plan. Similarly, envisioning, the right-hand column has decreased. Engaging stakeholders and some focused feedback groups, and also utilizing the visioning and POG, which you'll hear about tonight, that portrait of a graduate application, taking that input to inform our plan. And finally, with facilities assessment, continued collaboration with the Franklin Facilities Department, Kessel Booz and Associates, Dr. Locker, and her team to lead and look at the facilities in general as a whole and help inform. So all these pieces come together to put a plan, a school master plan, if you will, together for us as a district. And we're trying to really focus on three areas: instructional delivery that meets the needs of all of our learners, distribution and organization of students and grade levels in a logical, sequential way, and three, facilities utilization that meets the needs of all of our educational programming within the walls and is the right size fit for the district and the number of students we have and the types of programs we offer. And I added a snapshot from one of the reports that was done in 2020, which talked about utilization and size. This will be posted on our website as well, along with all of the presentations. And it talked about master planning back in 2020, the need for a plan that looks at all of these aspects. And finally, it provided a 10-year need and a roadmap that I think this report is available and online. We recognize that report as a standalone was never intended to be a standalone report to make all decisions. If you look at that report closely, it talks about these recommendations with a master plan, with a long-term plan, with a strategy, is how you develop options that are viable for the district. And our goal is to deliver on that to you all as a school committee and to have a plan for the district. This is right out of our district redistricting analysis report, where we talked about school facilities master planning at the end. It's very similar to the report that was done and just talks through those steps. So that's just a refresher for everyone at home in context. Tonight is about educational adequacy, visioning, portrait of a graduate, and the work ahead. So I'm very pleased, as I mentioned, Dr. Fran Locker is here joining us today, and she has prepared information regarding her work within the district and facilitation, and I'm going to kick it over to you.
All right, thank you. Good to be here. So a few preliminaries before I get into the presentation. I have a show for you with 19 slides. I could present this in sequence, and if it's just simply me presenting, it'll take 20 to 30 minutes, and then we can have Q&A. Or we can have Q&A all the way, and pause if there's anything that's really topical for you. How would you like to proceed? And I have no guarantee on how long that's going to take.
Why don't, it's all right with everybody else. Why don't you go present, and then we'll kind of do a Q&A after the fact. So we'll go through those 19 slides, and we'll do the Q&A there.
Okay, that's nice.
All right, perfect.
All right. And so I do want to point out that in the slide presentation, there's a lot of fine print. The fine print comes because we have done a phenomenal amount of work, and your stakeholders have been abundant. My job is to organize and then to facilitate, and, you know, so far workshops, but now we're moving into master planning, so I'm still organizing. But with the workshops, my job after facilitation is to listen and to record and document what your stakeholders have said. I mean, the way I look at it is these reports were really written by your stakeholders. I just was the person on the keyboard to get them in place. And so what I tend to do is literally record things as they say them, because I don't want to put words in people's mouth. These reports, it's true, are full of nuances. And also because of that, every one of them says draft, and particularly the portrait of a graduate, which has in it a good number of very consequential ideas. And I know that the subtle choice of a word can phenomenally alter the meaning of a phrase or a sentence. So I'm hoping that I don't arbitrarily just go and remove the draft on these, but I'm hoping that we have a process where it can be vetted, and I expect that that will have some minor changes to be made. So that's the prelude for all of this. I will also point out that my presentation for you tonight is somewhat of a trial run. As you will see, we've got a very busy week of sharing coming up, and I expect to modify this somewhat for that. But I want you to hear it first, and then I want to share it with other constituencies, and I will also then be listening to them and bringing back understandings ultimately to you, but to others as well. So that's the fine print, I suppose, at the beginning of this. And with that, then I'll dive into this. Right. So we did two sets of workshops. The first one, does the cursor work on this? Oh, here we are. Okay. So the first one was the Portrait of the Graduate Application Workshop. The key here is that we had 18 people doing this, and here are the constituencies they were speaking for or representing. Four students, and then you can see the rest of them. For the Educational Visioning, for which we had two workshops, we had 29 people. And to me, it's critical to know that of these total of 47 people, only five of them were at both of the workshops. This was a strategic move because I didn't want this process to be the choir talking to the choir. And I regarded it more as like dropping a pebble in a pond and having ripples. So with each step we take, we want a bigger ripple, and we want to embrace more people. We want more people understanding and ultimately committed to this long journey that we're going to have, which will probably initially be most visible in some facilities changes. And I say that because it's, believe it or not, it's usually easier to change facilities than it is to change education. But maybe this will prove me wrong, and maybe we'll see it in education. And there's a reason I'm cautioning myself, and I'll show you that reason in just a minute. All right. So here we are, 47 people, 42 unique individuals, and we're going to proceed forward. And I expect that we will grow those ripples in our pond between now and, say, the end of May. There are 77 pages of text in the reports so far, not counting the appendices that have various presentations in them. And that's a lot of words. I tried to distill that down to something that was just so essential that it might be the one page that people would print. And here it is. This path forward has three pieces to it. This came out of our workshops, and it's my kind of super overview of the big points. The first one is communication. This came, I mean, I don't know how many times that word was used, but it predominated much of the conversation as we got to the end of the educational visioning. And it simply is, people, our participants so far are looking for a new level of dialogue. Not that you haven't had dialogue in the past, but they're feeling now we've got a focus, now we've got a mission, now we've got a tethering point, to things to talk about. And it's ingrained in us. And so this communication piece is paramount. And my cliff notes here also say, you know, communication with students and with retired community members and everyone in between to refine and define and improve these. Because, by the way, these are the ideas that we have right now. As we go through the process and as we engage more people and as we listen to them, these ideas, you know, the ideas I'm going to share with you, they're going to shift a little bit. But that's inherently the nature of innovative ideas as they go through a sharing process. And if we were to be rigid and say, no, the POG committee did that and that's it, we would not be embracing people and we would not be enjoying the thoughts of people whom we could not squeeze into the room that day. We only have room for, well, you know that room upstairs. I expect things will shift, but I also believe that we have a wonderful foundation, a very complete foundation, and that it will be solidified and built upon as we move forward. So the first is communication. The second is culture change. And to support the POG and to foster improved learning and teaching, as was defined in the educational visioning, our participants are looking for a shift. One that recognizes that students learn in different ways, that embraces the whole student, and that offers multiple school and futures options for students. Now, the background on this is that there is a strong belief that if one were to define the culture of the district, particularly at the secondary level, particularly at the high school level, it might be called a test prep, test, and high grades culture, which is not unusual. I mean, it didn't surprise me to hear it. I've worked in a lot of Massachusetts communities. I've worked in communities in lots of other places as well. And high-achieving communities often have this as their mantra. And that's not a bad thing, but it's not necessarily appropriate for all students. And it, as a single culture, or as I'll call it a single-minded culture, it leaves many students out. There is a very expressed concern among high school stakeholders that we should be developing pathways, we should be aligning our education system with future opportunities that our students are going to be facing, and that even that value alone challenges having a single focus culture, because it leaves that out. So there are lots of ways to do this, and therefore, as I distill this down to simple words that don't place criticism, it is culture change right there, the middle bullet. The last one is what I could probably distill into a couple of just the simple words is make a practical facilities master plan. And yes, that master plan has to support the educational vision, which incorporates the POG. That's a given. But it should also minimize disruption of existing buildings while using those buildings. And so this is not a matter of being cavalier and saying, oh, the ideal is this and we're going to get it hell or high water. It's a matter of being very practical, the bottom bullet, ultimately producing good value for money for the taxpayer. Make a series of practical decisions as we translate all of this documentation with the architects to develop options for what we should be doing with your facilities. We will be guided by these, what did I say, 77 pages of text. you know, there's a lot of judgment calls in there, but I have to admit that it's absolutely exciting work because we're taking deeply developed educational concepts and translating them, converting them into what they need for facilities. I actually don't know of what would better work an educational planner to do. So that's the, if there's only one slide that you walk away from tonight's presentation, please walk away with this one, all right? I'm gonna talk a little bit about the application workshop. And this, I'm using some photos on the right. We had a very busy day, and we developed a series of focused pieces for the POG, which I'll tell you about in a second. We should have had 2 days in retrospect. But it seemed too disruptive, only because there was so much to talk about. And it seemed too disruptive when we were setting this up to take people away from that. Isn't that curious how that has switched? Two slides here that make the point for the POG. The first is it takes a community to make the POG a living document. I had asked the POG planning group, the application workshop group, who's the keeper of this? Who holds this? In 5 years, we say POG, who do we look to see that we're still doing it? And I thought the answer might be, oh, you know, the superintendent's office. That's a logical, hierarchical way of watching over it. The participants in this workshop were adamant that it's everybody, including this wonderful concept that it's all of us in 02038. And in a sense, that's maybe a little generalized and hard to maintain, but the spirit of it is, I think, exactly what we need. So, you know, the work that follows this is to do the work to get the POG into everybody's consciousness at every school. And the details of that are, you'll see some of them in a minute. But I thought it was a wonderful response. The other thing is this. We are already doing this to some extent. So the fine print on the POG application is it's calling for, well, you can see on the left-hand side, supporting practices for the POG, student-centered learning, student choice on meaningful issues, active, engaged learning, project-based learning, Socratic seminars were cited, and social-emotional learning embedded in the daily classroom practices. And this got so fine-grained that our participants, and they were largely the four high school students we had, identified by name teachers that they said, were already role models for Prince. And that to me is, in there, and those people are in the report. I also expect that they are just the tip of the iceberg because we didn't really have, we didn't have any middle school students, we didn't have any elementary school students, and so we got the focus on the high school, which is fine. But the point being, you don't want an outsider like me to say, this is what you should be doing. You want to turn to somebody who is already with you, who's doing it, and then groom them to train others, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's the ripple in the pond idea. In this regard, we'll be starting with the initial ripple of people who are already with us. And that can be a terribly exciting process. It's also a challenging management process. But, you know, it's kind of on our list of things to be doing. So we are already doing this to some extent. And as with any district of this size, it's not universal. It's pockets here and pockets there, but we've got them. And then there are contradicting practices for the POG application. And I'm not going to read all of these. The helicopter teachers comes from, it's maybe for many of the participants, the first time that concept has ever been with them, the notion of teachers hovering over students to and this is often an elementary school practice, teachers hovering over students to assure that they don't make a mistake. And we know that you do your best learning when you make a mistake and then regroup from it. That term was resonating by the time we finished our workshop. Relying on lecturing to deliver curriculum content, that was like the least desired modality of any. And then here's where the test scores begin to appear. These were what we're already doing to some extent, et cetera. So let me move on. I had organized this so that we would create a portrait of a learner. So we already had a portrait of a graduate, but to support it, I wanted them to create a portrait of a learner, a portrait of a teacher, a portrait of a classroom, a school, and a district. And they said, hey, wait a minute, you're missing one. You're missing the parent. I said, okay, we'll add that to your list, create a portrait of a parent. And so these last couple of slides are just characterizing the different portraits that they developed. I'm not going to read all of these to you. You can see, some of the... Here's an interesting one. Interdisciplinary learning, which came up as one of the qualities or one of the modalities that we preferred, that they preferred. Now in the elementary schools and at the high school, but in the electives, not necessarily in the basic core, English, math, social studies, etc. Hands-on learning, essential skills. A lot of in the POG are what used to be called soft skills, but that word has become politically inappropriate because it has a soft connotation, and now we use the word essential skills, and the group grabbed onto that, and that's why it's crossed out here. Priorities for teaching students about time management and making mistakes and handling mistakes. So that was the learner. The teacher, social-emotional learning embedded in the instruction, not a separate, not, okay, we've got 45 minutes, we're going to do SEL, but have SEL embedded in the way students are working. Project-based learning, making things, STEM, etc. And then seminar instruction. A number of the students had had experience in seminar instruction and they were big supports. Portrait of a classroom, left hand side. The POG is visible and applied, K-12. Collaborative learning. Students critique and discuss each other's work. basically, students become teachers in a certain way. Portrait of a school. Everybody knows the POG. Well, of course, that would make sense. Parents and teachers and parents are learners too. And honoring diverse learners. Portrait of a district. Share the common mission, vision. Collaboration across different levels and content. Viable sense of mission. And I think we can be there. Contact with families is regular, focused, and intentional. We now certainly have something common to talk about. And then the portrait of the parent, the one that was by popular demand. Engaged, collaborative, solution-oriented, informed, allowing your kid to take risks and make mistakes. That kind of ties into this test prep issue. So, you know, like the butterfly effect, everything's connected to everything else. Then we had the educational visioning workshops, 2 days with only a small amount of overlap. So part of the issue, of course, was for this new group of people to understand what the previous group of people had done. And to that end, I did some presentations related to that, and I think we got that pretty much across. I'm not going to go through this agenda, but I do want to highlight this one element right here. So in the effort to squeeze as much learning in the least amount of time, I always have videos over lunch, and then we watch the video and we talk about it. This time, I shared the trailer on Ted Lasso. How many of you have seen Ted Lasso? Only one or two of you? Oh wow, you're gonna have to subscribe to Apple TV Plus. Because I preceded it with the High Tech High Graduate School of Education position paper. Well, that's where that red paper is. Look at that, it's over there for some reason. High Tech High Graduate School of Education, are you familiar with High Tech High? It's probably the most iconic high school in the country. There was a documentary about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago called Most Likely to Succeed. I'm not seeing, okay, put that on your list, Most Likely to Succeed. And it's a school in California that, in fact, has been doing many of the things that would be supporting your POG. They've been doing it since the 1990s. It is that Most Likely to Succeed is a documentary that's chronicling how their method of education, which does not look like a typical high school, actually prepares kids for the future better than a typical high school education does. And their college placements are phenomenal. So I'll work with your administration to get that into your culture. High Tech High set up its own graduate school of education because it found out, because it learned it had to retool teachers from what they had learned in their education schools. And they just came out with a position paper which is called Can Ted Lasso Save Education? Now, the key element of the Ted Lasso show was that you need to believe, you need to have a sense of mission, and that you support the people you are with. You support, well, Ted was the coach, so he supported the players in a very engaged and loving way, but with believe in the person as the bottom line. So that position paper I shared with them, and it's in the appendices of the report. So you will easily be able to see it when we release the report. I share this as another way of underscoring this wonderful world that we're now exploring and talking about very consciously. Moving on. We wrapped up our 2 days of visioning with key words, and our participants filled out what they thought was the key word for education of the future and the key word for facilities, and they held them up, and our superintendent made one long run-on sentence that combined them all. And the reason for this is that as we go along in this process, and as we talk with other groups, it seems to me that if the keywords we were using had been generated by your stakeholders in the visioning, that we would be close to the mark. This is not where you want an outsider like me to make up a bunch of words to describe what they had done. So let's go with the words that they had described. So look at those words: engaging, enriching, equitable, and for education, problem solving under education, individualized under education. And look at the words under facilities: flexible, functional, fewer, newer, and larger. How about quite different? So, we may not use all of those words, but these words are going to be certainly characterizing the master planning work that we've got coming up, and I think we can be handy as we talk with other constituencies. All right, into the depth of what they had said. So I've organized this report with overarching principles, instructional models under the idea of guiding principles. And I'm not going to read these, but I will characterize some of them. Teach the POG at the same time as traditional content. Build stronger relationships, yes. Staff PD, you have a lot of staff PD in your future. That's a good thing. I know it's a hard thing because of time limitations, because of cost, etc. But there's got to be a professional staff development in order to make this stuff really, really work. And we have taken some steps with Bob Dutch onto what that might look like. We parked them because we're not ready to really dive into that yet, but that's coming. Instructional models increase student engagement by the way the classroom activity is unfolding. Interdisciplinary as much as possible, and as I pointed out, you have that in some places. This one came up early and came back again several times. Advisor-advisee programs in the high school and the middle schools were regarded as really great ideas, but in the details of how they're executed, basically the students had a high degree of concern for them, particularly at the high school level, which is, they're both constrained by very short periods of time. And you can't get into deep conversations in a short period of time. And the high school students were very vocal about it. A movement to shift to larger schools with a minimum of 3 classrooms per grade in the elementary schools and 4 curriculum area teachers per grade in the middle schools. So that's a bit higher than you generally have right now. And expand special needs in the district, and don't take for granted what you've got now in district and out of district, but look to make them more accessible, basically more accessible and probably less expensive. That in itself is its own project. And then shift the elementary grades from K to 5 to a pre-K 2 followed by a 3-5. And there were a number of reasons to do this. Most emphatically and educationally is that you have a larger pool of educators at any school focused on the developmental needs of that particular age. And the one that's particularly critical here are those early years, K to 2 or pre-K to 2. And then this also establishes continuity, which your ECDC, your ECDC as a standalone is a great institution, but it doesn't have continuity with other grades. So they're looking for continuity. I can move on. The pre-K was seen as benefiting by being in multiple locations and growing. There's an initiative in Massachusetts to fund universal pre-K in the gateway communities. I'm not sure where that word comes from, but it's Boston and Springfield and Everett and others that have lower socioeconomic populations. And the question is, will that then be the prelude to a greater expansion over the years? But basically, this is looking to do the planning to see that you're prepared for it. And of course, there's all these questions as to how that's funded, but we're doing master planning. So it's appropriate that we look at how that might be done. And I've worked in many, many school districts, and it always turns out that pre-K programs are restricted by the facilities that are available for them. It often turns out that pre-K programs are put in the least desirable old school buildings as well. So there's a pecking order, I suppose. But our role as master planners, facilities master planners, will then look at expanding ECDC possibilities in multiple locations.
We're fortunate too, Dr. Walker, that we had a pre-K that was designed as a pre-K. But certainly what limitations we're experiencing through the industry analysis was it's at capacity and beyond capacity at this time. So that was one of the outcomes of that study last year, which has led into the work that facilitated this year. Mm-hmm.
And I've been at work in a number of districts on master planning and pre-K. Did one in South Burlington, Vermont, where they did want to go to universal pre-K. They recognized that there were many private providers, and they didn't want to put those private providers out of business, and so they developed a scheme where, in fact, their school-based pre-K initiative embraced the private providers. I worked in Stamford, Connecticut, and did the opposite. They actually built a building that was intended to the Connecticut State of Connecticut funding, so they can do this. It's a bit different than Massachusetts, but to make the point, there are different ways to do this. In Stamford, Connecticut, they're making a building that will have private providers in it, as well as public employees. So I guess the bottom line is there's lots of innovative ways to make pre-K more effective, and maybe we'll invent a different way here in Franklin. School organization, fewer and larger elementary schools, fewer and larger middle schools, and then interdisciplinary small learning communities and thematic pathways. You've got your arts academy, but the thinking is to have more of them, and this ties in with students that learn in different ways and students that may not want to go to college and lots that doesn't fit into the test culture. Then let me just focus on middle school classrooms, future pre-K. We are seeing, well, you know this because you've got the update on the enrollments. So we're going to have a slight drop in enrollments, and then it's going to rise slightly, but not quite to where we are now. We are just at the point in the master planning process of matching that with existing building classroom counts. So if you see me next week, I'll be able to tell you more. But the notion is that we're feeling there's going to be a little wiggle room, and we're going to see what we can do with that to basically meet the goals that have been identified in the visioning. Sorry, I lost my train of thought on what I was going to share with you on that. Where you have most visible inadequacy are on your services. Your classrooms aren't bad. There's a couple that really don't, that are too small. But the way you are serving students with special needs, the way you are serving guidance in other non-special needs special services is, I guess the best word I have for it is, in many cases, ad hoc. If you've got the square footage for it, but you've appropriated, and this is no surprise because school districts do this all the time, you've appropriated rooms that are big, but should be small, and therefore you've got noise problems, disruption problems for the most sensitive most sensitive of needs. And so what we are going to do as we do our master planning is we're not going to take for granted what you have. We are going to right size the special services and the special ed needs. So it may turn out that you have a building that's got currently 12 classrooms, and we're going to say you really have to count it as 10 because we need to do better planning for those special services. So that's what's coming next. All right. And I'm not sure that this tells us anything that we haven't said already, and I realize I have gone well beyond my time. Here we are, right here. We have a big day coming up, big week coming up in a couple of weeks when I will be sharing concepts with, you can see them all here, everybody. These meetings are actually workshops. I will be sharing with them these concepts, and we will have them working in teams of 6 people, and we will be asking them what their hopes and concerns are for all of this. And we will record all of that, and you will get all of it. And this is how, as I say, whatever we've done so far is a great start, but it'll change a little bit as we hear more from other people. So we're going to do that on April 8th, 9th, and 10th. We're going to go back. And once we have some master planning concepts, but that has not yet been scheduled. So the first is to talk about the POG and the Ed Vision, and then come back later once we know what this means for master planning. The master planning team, Castle Blues and me, here we are. We're developing the options in April and May. We're going to be reviewing them with the administrative leaders. And then we're going to be reporting, as I just say, and there will inherently be revisions. And then May and June, I expect we're going to come back and see you again and the CFC. So it's a busy couple of months. So I believe that is, oh, and here we are. So back to the path forward, which you've seen already. And that's what I have to present to you.
Thank you, Warren. Yeah. Well, I know you're going to say your pieces. I just want to add that through this process, I think we had representative stakeholders in the room providing feedback, and I think I appreciated your ripple effect and kind of expanding the conversation now to other group forums and groups of folks that are connected to this by the stakeholders that were in the room that day that represent. But we recognize through this process, I think, that we're going through that there are a lot of different ways that we can bring this work. But one thing we're committed to is trying to put forth the best possible plan that has a short-term and a long-term plan for this work. So, Brent, thank you for your work with that. I just wanted to clarify that piece. And no, you mentioned and referenced in this presentation, which we will provide, it does talk about different configurations, and there's different ways in which this can look that are yet to be determined. And you heard a few examples and the rationale for that. I appreciate the context to that. But certainly we have work to do in those areas to see how we should best be, we should best set ourselves up along with this. So thank you.
And Dr. Locke, you know, thank you very much for this great presentation. I'm going to open it up to questions in just a moment. But you know, first, Steve, I'm going to steal your line. The other day, I told him this was a proverb that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I really think that you know, that's such a one of the biggest reasons why we wanted to kind of really kind of pull out. You know, from the subcommittee, kind of present to the whole school committee itself, and you know, just to the overall public as well, because what we are trying to do here is to kind of go far, and I want to be able to, you know, want to try to get as much really stakeholder, you know, really kind of get out there to the full committee, to the full community as well. As we start having a lot of these conversations. Again, thank you so much for this presentation. Now I'll open the floor to any questions, comments.
Yeah, it's a great presentation. I just want to know about you used a term called helicopter teachers. It's totally different point. It's a great view, I think. Could you please elaborate? What is exactly meant by helicopter teachers?
Yeah. So the term comes from Jennifer Klein, who is an educational consultant, and she's out of Denver. I've known her since 2014, I think. But I asked her to join us as a cameo presenter because she had presented at the NEASC conference just earlier this year. And they are, you know, the keeper of the portrait of the graduate. And so her talk was, in a sense, the portrait of the graduate in the real world or in the education world. And she coined a phrase or used a phrase called helicopter teachers in the sense of helicopter mothers, which is pretty much culturally understood. And she had a variation on it, and it would be lawnmower teachers. So it is that teachers, particularly at the early years, and I'm paraphrasing Jennifer, want to do well for kids and often try to facilitate their being successful by not letting them make mistakes, not letting them fail. And she emphasized the power of teachers letting kids fail and then picking themselves up and, you know, and growing better. So it's a subtlety, and actually we can get her presentation if that's, it probably is critical that we do that. It's a good idea. But it resonated well with our workshop participants.
Hi, thank you for that presentation and for compiling all that information. I got to be part of those workshops, and it's a lot to kind of sum up, I'm sure. I'm curious, so you mentioned in the beginning, like, our schools are sort of test prep, high grade culture. And in the beginning, we mentioned that you were here in 2011 when we developed the Franklin Arts Academy Association. Not great with acronyms, but the FAA here. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about, like, how did you do that? Was that, did you feel like back then we were as much of a kind of high pressure cooker kind of district? Were things a little bit more fluid back then? And the world more open back then? I'm just kind of, it wasn't that long ago. So that.
I wasn't trying to avoid being on the spot. I just wanted to clarify. The superintendent said that I was a part of your starting the Arts Academy. No, you already had that.
Oh, okay.
I embraced it.
Yeah.
And I've been telling just about every school that I've worked with since then about it. And to me, it represents a large school recognizing that not every child works the same. And basically having the courage to open up a school within a school. The power of it, to me, is distilled in one simple concept. Your Arts Academy at that time had a course called How to See Economically in Life Despite Being an Artist. And we know arts, anyone who chooses to be an artist, whether it's a graphic artist or a fine artist or a musical artist, it's very hard to earn a living. And I know that in a typical departmental high school with a cafeteria menu of electives, you would never ever have a course called how to survive economically as an artist. It takes a focused academy like that to even think of something like that. And that just warms my heart. And that is related to arts. Now, if you had several different academies, or as came up so much in the conversation, pathways, what if the high school had five different pathways? You will probably have the same kind of focus that is very specific to the goals or the missions of each of those pathways, And things will happen that you would never have thought of before if you remain a traditional electives choice-based high school, departmental-based high school. So, you know, the pathways concept is just really rich in terms of what you can do. And they're all aligned with national standards. They're aligned with opportunities for kids to go on to not necessarily go to college. You know, the whole test prep thing is about getting into college. So we're not reaching all of our kids. And that's what the concern about meeting pathways is about.
To follow up and just add to that, Fran, through the budget conversations we've had over the past few weeks, you've heard us advocate for, when I think back to the FAA and its inception and kind of development through, I know over time the goal of our system has been to support all of the courses and coursework and pathways that we're trying to develop. One of the pulls and investments in the budget proposal that went before you a few weeks ago, or actually was it just last week? It was just last week, was around trying to show a commitment to stabilizing our core staff, staffing our buildings appropriately, and then creating opportunities for pathways that could be developed and have the elective coursework that you could tie together to create student experiences as they enter and exit high school. And to Dr. Locker's point, it's not just college bound, but through those pathways, try to look for ways to create credentialing opportunities, continue to look for ways to organize students and provide the right number of electives that support one of the focus areas that they're trying to achieve. So I just would point that the budget conversation we had is exactly in line with what you just shared. So
you know me, I'm all about budget. So one of the things, I love the keeper of the POG, this is our zip code. I just think in the conversations that we're having, so much of it is community-based outside of just the schools right now, given our budget deficit. So I kind of want to take advantage of having you here and just maybe see if I could ask one more question that's sort of open-ended. You know, you mentioned like we get these like deeply developed educational concepts and then we try to communicate it to the zip code sharing the POG vision. I guess I'm just trying to ask, like, do you have any advice on that? Because I find that schools often are so data driven. Everything they say, you know, can be backed by numbers and stats and modeling and the research is there. And then when you get up in front of people who are outside of the education industry, a lot of times it's hard to convey that this stuff is proven, you know, this is what we need to do. So just generally speaking, have any tidbits? We can come back to that. Again, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I just know you have a wealth of information with making big moves with towns and encouraging that risk taking. And we're sort of there right now. And I'm somebody who's really trying to liaise with the community, and it's challenging.
Yes. It's easier to talk to the choir. Talk to those that are in the system than it is to do the outreach to get either parents or empty nesters. And we have those on our list. What often happens, I believe, is that those other constituencies, well, let's start with the empty nesters, are most visible when it comes to talking about taxes or a bond issue or anything that impacts their supporting the schools financially. But so therefore those conversations tend to be kind of emergency driven rather than all the time, right? With parents, and I'm going to come back around to them and say, with parents, the conversations often are driven by their children, which is appropriate, but that can often be somewhat reactive to their child's situation in school, as opposed to proactive about the nature of school. And so it's difficult. It's simple to say, it is difficult to do. I've come from a conference in Newport, and tomorrow I'll be speaking on a number of things, but one of them is care and feeding of parents, which bottom line on it is that we need more venues that are meaningful to have a continuing dialogue. And I've got some examples of schools where we've got places in the facilities that invite them. A case in point. Your ECDC has kids who are there for a short period of time. And I learned when I was working in a similar building in Newton, Mass, that the parents of the kids who were in their preschool for like 2 or 3 hours were sitting in the lobby with their laptops trying to do work because it was easier to sit there than it was to drive all the way home and drive back again. So we stole that idea at a school I have in Cartagena in Colombia, and we made a parent center which has basically a co-working space. But we stole another idea that I got from Sacramento, which was a poverty school that wanted to have their kids do some service learning, and they found a janitor's closet in the front in a lobby, and they set up a portable barista bar on wheels. And they started, those fifth graders started making and selling cappuccinos to the parents as they came to pick up the kids, right? And what they found happening was, you know, a parent can come and pick up their kid in 10 minutes, but when they started selling cappuccinos, the parents started coming early so they could talk to other parents. And so these kids were not learning to be good baristas, they were building a community. Now they hit, so we stole that idea too.
That's what I
want to
do.
Yeah, well, I mean, the best thing is always to steal what other people have done, because number one, it's more things than you could ever think of on your own, but also you know who to talk to make it work even better. So I don't know the snappy answer to your question, but I do know that your question is spot on, and we need those other constituencies in order to be sustainable on everything else. And so I would suggest what we do, the way forward is, as we do our next grouping of meetings and asking people, we should, Dr. Gajer, are we going to have in those meetings in April representatives from community members?
We have a community forum planned for, so folks from the community, we have a parent opportunity and a community opportunity.
Okay.
So the short answer is yes, we do.
So there you go. That's our first big ask. And I think the way it goes is, how do we keep you sustained into the long-term community? What's interesting? What brings you back again and again and again? In some school districts, it's spaghetti. No, I'm serious. I don't think you have the demographics, but you know, in some towns in Massachusetts, the way to get parents to show up to meetings and others to show up to meetings is to offer a free dinner. And as crass as that sounds, that's the culture, and that's the secret to it. So we may find out. I'll ask the question.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The only last question I had was at the bottom when we present to school committee and CFC. What's CFC?
Comprehensive facility.
Oh, that's the.
It's a subcommittee, but it's.
Okay.
That's what I was told.
Yeah, I don't know.
So yeah, I guess it's technically CFC.
That's all I got. Thank you so much. I appreciate all the work.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Locke. We really appreciate you coming up with this information to us. Yeah, a lot of really interesting, innovative ideas, and it's great to get the feedback from the community and the different stakeholders that showed up to the meeting. So yeah, thank you for doing all this work and putting this together for us, and on the work that you're going to continue to do as part of this master facilities, comprehensive school facilities analysis plan. One thing that I would like, well, just clarification on it, you mentioned, you said this is part of the different pathways concept. I think you call them thematic interdisciplinary small learning communities. Could you maybe just expand upon what those are and what those look like practically?
Yeah. That's a lot of words in one piece. Okay, a small learning community is an idea that has developed pretty strongly among educational planners in the last 20 years, which is very different than the long the corridor with separate rooms that have predominated school design building, school facilities design for, you know, 100 years now. And the key element of it is that instead of thinking of classrooms as if they were on a highway, you know, one after another with a speed zone in the middle of them, create a gathering spot that brings together people. And the next development of it, so my easiest way of speaking about it is, instead of making your corridors long and skinny, make them short and wide. And therefore, your classrooms surround them. It's the same amount of square footage, only when it gets wider, it can be used with furnishings, and it can be used for education. Now, when you parlay that into a school, you might have, you know, six of these. If each one holds 150 people, you might have four of them, and you'll get a 600 student school. That's tied in with some research that 150 people is the most number of people that most people can know well. And then you ask yourself, do you care if they know each other well, or do you not care? If you don't care, it doesn't matter. If you do care, then you have to begin thinking about the dynamics of group size. And a small learning community can physically focus that dynamic. So then if you extend that conversation one more and take it to, say, a high school level, and you have each of the different disciplines in it, math, science, English, social studies, you can have a self-contained small learning community. You can then begin to have interdisciplinary connections. So the English teacher might be working with the history teacher, the math teacher might be working with the science teacher, or any other combination. And you are bringing more to the student, in part because teachers are working together and they're role modeling collaboration. In part, my personal research shows that when teachers work together synchronously, same time, a student who needs help goes to the teacher that they feel most comfortable with. So if you had an English teacher working with a history teacher in a combined course, and this would be my daughter, and she had a problem with her history, but she didn't like the history teacher, or didn't feel comfortable, she would go talk to the English teacher, who, for that, you know, grade level, can probably solve meet the need and solve the problem. We see that over and over again, that students, when seeking help, are actually seeking relationships rather than seeking the holder of the content knowledge. And so once we break our schools away from a strict departmental organization, which limits the school planning into content knowledge areas, once we break away from that, we open up the possibilities that relationships are going to rule the day. That's human nature.
Thank you for the explanation. That's a really interesting concept. So this is tied into, you're saying, like the actual physical layout of the school buildings themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah, and so, but David, in order to just try to bring some connections to this conversation, that model is very different physically from what you have.
Yeah.
And it is possible with minimal, and I'm just reading it here, there it is right there, minimal disruption to existing facilities to the greatest extent reasonably possible. We're still gonna honor that. Picture in your mind a row of classrooms along the corridor, say three on each side, okay? You take one of the ones that's in the middle and you cut a hole in the wall so it flows into the corridor. All of a sudden you've created a space that can be shared by five others. And that's a building block for minimal disruption within the kind of buildings that you have. It's not where we would start ideally, but it gets an awful lot of the job done. And so you get it quickly into the fine grain of what's achievable and what's not achievable.
Can I add to that too, Dr. Larkin? You brought up in your envisioning, you can have larger schools with small communities built within them if you organize yourself correctly. And you create within, for the examples that Dr. Locker gave around ways in which you can organize within to create micro communities within a school setting when you start to think about that. It's how a high school can have a small freshman experience for kids. It's how you can look to organize by what are the interests of students and what are they pursuing as they try to graduate and cross that threshold with a diploma. What were their interests and what courses did they compile, and how do you create some consistency, and that's how you build some community. So I think what I appreciated from the comments during that session was around looking at, if we are truly looking at this the way we kicked off this meeting, which was master planning, and looking at, let's everyone get up from their table, let's look at the whole district, let's look at every school, every space, how are we educating students at all levels and of all ability, and how are we doing it across every single school that we have, and then let's now, before we sit back down, let's try to get to a place where we consider, we have an opportunity right now to set a course. I think, yeah, Dr. Locker, you brought that up during the visioning, but I think you've just illustrated that it's really about trying to look at how do we align our programming to create these thematic spaces or these smaller communities within the larger context, and it's doable. Mm-hmm.
I have a thriving 3-8 school in North Ridgeville, Ohio. We consolidated 3 school buildings to make it. It's got 2,200 kids in it. 19 small learning communities, two separate libraries, separate drop-offs, etc. Their state-based test scores have gone through the roof for a lot of reasons, including professional staff development. But including, once we had set up those communities, the district made each one of them autonomous so that the teachers within those communities completely control the schedule, the placement of the kids, where they are, who's teaching what. And so on any given day, your 19 communities do not look alike because the teachers have the control. So they've moved the decision-making about the daily activities of the kids to those who know the kids best. And it's a wonderful model. It tells me if we plan things right, larger schools can be places where kids are going to thrive because we're touching on lots of things. My first really large building was a 925 student K2 in the 1990s. We had three bus drop-offs, one at each wing, because those kids have short legs. And those kids didn't even know about the rest of the school because they walked right in the door to their wing. And yeah, when they went to the cafeteria, they went to a joint space, but for all of it, those kids lived in a small school. And that's what we want to achieve. And we can.
Well, thank you very much for expanding on that. And that explanation is a very, very interesting concept. And again, thank you for all the work you've done thus far and what we're taking you on. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. And can I say thank you for this opportunity? I love this stuff.
Appreciate this. Can we switch back to the next step slide? Just want to just talk about that. So we have our forums in April. Can you paint a picture of like what are the expectations of the forum for the participants? Mm-hmm. We have a secondary community, elementary students, and admin team. Can you expand like what are people going to expect once they go to these sessions, and how do they participate? Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
So. I believe we got these in hour and a half modules, if I'm not remembering.
90-minute sessions.
90-minute sessions, okay. So the format is to the best extent possible, have tables of six people, diverse as much as possible, and I share with them an abbreviated version of this, otherwise I'll use up the whole 90 minutes. And then ask them some really simple questions. What are your hopes? What are your concerns? What do we do to alleviate concerns? So that's pretty open-ended. If you've got six people sharing their ideas, recording their ideas on some flip charts, we're going to get an awful lot of responses. The nice thing about asking the same question to multiple tables is that they come up with very similar answers. You probably have answers that are pretty correct. If they come up with completely different things, it might mean that we have more work to do to ask again. And we'll only know when we get there. But as with the visioning and the POG application, my job is to listen well, take notes, and sift through it all and figure out where we go from there. And you'll see it all.
And just to confirm, so we have educators,
secondary educators would be our teachers, the community, which would be both parents, guardians, Franklin residents. And this would be a really great opportunity for them to share their voice, share their thoughts, perspectives, in a manner with other people, both supporting and non, and just kind of have a discussion. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I haven't done the invites. Perhaps someone else in the room here can tell you more about how those groups are formed.
We also have table volunteers who participated during the multi-day workshops to sit at each table to help facilitate and guide some of the questions and keep the conversations moving to flow to allow for the airspace to collect and gather information. We've already reached out to those folks and they've been committing to Dr. Rogers on who can attend tonight.
Okay, and for the community folks that are coming to provide the feedback, is that an open invitation? I guess
it will be an open invitation. I think we're going to try to work through Franklin Matters to try to put that out publicly that way, as a way, and in addition to our site and pushing it out to, we could put it back out to families to share more broadly, but we see that as the best way. Maybe we can even put it on the Franklin TV runner.
Sure.
So that's on the public access as well. Announce it at meetings and try to engage the community as much as possible.
Cool. And then the students, is the part that's interesting to me. Can you elaborate on the rationale behind that?
About asking students?
Yes, exactly. Just a few.
Oh, I. It's so. Sorry. It's so natural to me. I never thought it was. The students are the ones we always forget to ask. I mean, my guess is that any of our participants who were at POG or the EdVision would say, what would we have done without the students? And interesting, what I usually see are that when having students join workshops like that over several days, the first day they are a little timid and kind of wondering why they're there. The second day they've staked out their position and the adults at the tables are asking them what the answers are. And if we go to a third day, they're in control of the room. And it's a beautiful thing.
Appreciate the sentiment, and I agree. I think people end up losing sight of who this is all for, and adults make assumptions based off what's important to them and not necessarily what's important to those that will be impacted and that will be living with our decisions. So appreciate that inclusion of that student perspective, because at the end of the day, regardless of what decision we make as adults, they're the ones that will live with it for the most formative years of their lives. So it's good to have that perspective as we move forward.
So I just don't want to give up on the student question. So I have found, my sense is that many people might fear that the students are going to be a little frivolous or, you know, out of control. I have found that when you treat the students as adults, you put them in the same situation as the adults at the table, they rise to the occasion. I don't give them their own table and say, oh, that's the students' table. I expect that they are participating on an even playing with any adult in the room. And they do.
So I would just say, I'm going to put my own parent hat on. There are times where I anticipate as a parent, my kids are going to struggle with something in our life, and 9 times out of 10, they're not as impacted as I'm fully worried. So I just think it's natural. I just want to normalize that for everyone out there in the world, like as a human to human. Sometimes we anticipate kids are going to struggle more than they do, and I think what's interesting is through these forums, the way we did it, in Dr. Locker, the way you incorporated the students into those the vision of the workshops, we're going to have, they'll have, just like every other constituent group, they'll have their opportunity to be together in different ways. So we're looking at creative ways to engage kids at the middle level, elementary level, and high school level as part of this work, and model it after what the adults will have experienced with your facilitation. And we have a way to do that flexibly during the school that we can manage that. So I appreciate your comments. I think that's important.
Thank you.
So definitely, you know, thank you for the time and the effort put in here, just kind of collating such a diverse group of opinions. And I think there's really a lot that goes into being able to present this in such a manner that, you know, you're capturing a lot of different thoughts, a lot of different ideas kind of across the board, but, you know, looking at teachers, looking at parents, looking at the community. And I think that it really is important, especially now when there are a lot of diverse opinions, to see that there are these anchoring points that are widely shared. So I just want to thank you for that. And I think plenty of questions for you after getting a chance to read the report, looking at things. So looking forward to the May-June timeframe. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate the time.
Thank you. And if I could just comment on that. So when you do the report, be sure you look at the reporting on each day, the notes. The magic of facilitating multiple groups at tables of six is, as I said earlier, when you ask a question and you get very similar answers, you're probably going in the right direction. In the notes, you will find out on each issue how many of the tables responded in that particular way. So for example, this notion of expanding the ECDC, you will see how many, I think we had five tables, you'll find out how many tables wanted to do that. On the issue of going to a pre-K 2 followed by 3 through 5, you'll get a sense as to how many tables wanted that. And that's how I judge how powerful the ideas are. And as I said, if we got answers that were all over the place, I wouldn't be able to pull a sense of direction out of it. But they were pretty emphatic. So I invite you to pick through the details.
Excellent. Thank you for pointing that out.
I also love the additional breakdown of the portraits, you know, the graduates formed by the teacher and the parent and the district, mm-hmm. and, you know, all of the above. So really liked that was, you know, kind of took such a deep dive into it. You know, thanks to Al for asking about the upcoming sessions, but then to get, you know, maybe even a bit more deep in here, and hopefully not too far in. You know, the 77 pages that you have, and probably the 77 more that you'll have a few weeks from now after the next sessions. How do you see all that kind of translating then into the, you know, planning the changes that might happen as a result of that, like as we move into the months that follow?
We haven't figured that out yet. What we have is a guide.
Yeah.
And I would expect that the way it really gets deployed at the high school is going to be different than the way it gets deployed at any of the elementary schools.
Right.
And even perhaps the way at one elementary school is different than another. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what that way forward is without having the background meetings to figure it out. In order for this to really hold, it cannot be, here's the idea, now go do it.
Right.
It's got to be grown out of each different culture.
Yeah, and then that kind of like fluid nature of looking at it, of, you know, this circumstance is going to be different from the next level of education from mm-hmm. the school that's mm-hmm. 5 miles down the road.
As an example, if we have one elementary school that has several teachers cited as already doing this, mm-hmm. that's a different dialogue than if we have another elementary school with no teachers cited.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
And so their paths could be quite different. It may be that we actually have PD with two schools so that we can share the wisdom of those who are already doing it. And, I mean, there is a management challenge here because you've got, you know, a good number of students, you've got a good number of teachers, and a good number of buildings. And so it's probably not going to be managed by renting a big armory and putting everybody in one space at one time. And then if we are going to have it for smaller groups, then the strategy question is, how do we do that so that we're equitable and that we have outcomes that can become universal or shared from one to another? And we just haven't gotten to that point yet.
Yeah. Looking forward to what's to come. Thank you.
As I say, I love this stuff.
Thank you.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you all very much for questions and for the terrific answers. I mean, I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing those next coming weeks and months and what's going to happen. I do want to throw it out and see if anybody in the chambers or if there's any kind of questions online as well.
Can I just make one comment, yes, Mr. Callahan, too? Just to be clear, we're going through this process and we're trying to follow a process that arrives at us having the information, sharing it, those turning into options, those options turning into recommendations, and ultimately, votes could come before you and should come before you if we're going to change direction and hopefully have the rationale and have done the work to engage not only the stakeholders but the professional expertise of folks like Dr. Locker, who is keynoting at an architectural conference tomorrow, and you're the final keynote speaker. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to take into consideration a couple of aspects. We have to look at a few things. We talked about it already. We talked about looking at our enrollment from today through the next decade. We have to look at the current existing conditions of all of our buildings, and are they suitable, and are they meeting the needs of all kids, and are we organized correctly? We have to also look at how are we, our educational vision for students, what's our short-term quick wins that can happen with no money and no change, minimal disruption, and what are some possible long-term options that we should be considering as well. This should all be part of a plan over the next, it should suit us for the next decade or beyond, but ultimately we're trying to gather the right information so that we have the choices in front of us that have you all able to make some decisions so that we can do our work to implement those decisions. But I think that's really what's in front of us, but we're really going through this in a process-driven way. But I just want to be clear on that. This work up front is critical in order to arrive at any type of option. And I just want to say that out of a way, it's almost like measured transparency to say that we owe it to our constituents and our students most of all to make sure that we're organizing ourselves in a way that makes the most sense to educate them at a high level and utilizes the space and the buildings we need in the space that all students deserve to be educated in. So I say that up front just to also mention that people are engaging with us at different points. Some of you have been engaged since Davis State Elementary closed. Some are joining us today for the first time in learning information. So I think the goal of the forums is to bring people up to speed of where we're at, what information we have, and then hear about their concerns, their ideas, their thoughts, and try to really bring people around on how we're arriving at options and recommendations to suit and really create a system for ourselves that's sustainable and is able to meet the needs of all of our students over the next decade. Does that make sense? So I just want to be clear. I heard the questions and I appreciate them. And I just wanted you to hear from me operationally of where this leads and how this work gets done. So,
fantastic. Thank you very much. Lois, please. Just name, address, and you know the drill.
Yes. I've seen it once or twice. Steve Sherlock, 13 Magnolia Drive, here at Franklin, of course. Volunteers, Franklin Matters, Franklin News. Respectfully, it was a African proverb that I've fortunately memorized and used occasionally, so it comes readily. but I can't take credit for it other than the memory, remembering, because it does serve in multiple places. But if you go back to that very first slide, the one slide, the takeaway, with the communications on that top line, that for me is something I've been saying for a while. A new level of dialogue. That's the key. You can talk about the statistics, but you gotta tell the story. And how do we tell the story? It's gonna take time. It's not quick and easy. The distillation of all of that data to make the picture, it will take time. I'm here to help you, but we need a lot more people to have that part of that dialogue, because it can't just be the coffees and the coffee clutches and this and that. New level of dialogue. These are going to be honest and serious, have to be respectful and civil discussions, of course, and we know there are different opinions, but put the opinions aside. It is 02038. It is our problem. We have to solve it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Rogers, anybody? Dr. Locke, I want to thank you once again for all the work that's already gone into this, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to be happening moving forward. To.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good luck with the keynote speech tomorrow as well.
I haven't finished it yet.
All right. And then, is there any other questions, comments? All right. Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Second.
Discussion?
Nope.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great night, everybody.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.